And I agree with you, by the way. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday, and it's Fridays with Sandy Williams, co-host. And, you know, you can join the conversation at 844-967-2789. Sandy, I can't believe how fast time has flown, and we've been on kind of like the same thing. I've got some other things I wanted to talk about, but let's go back to Tom first. Excuse me. Hey, Tom, what's going on?
First up, Sandy, God love you, but we got to get some facts straight. Number one, we can't keep buying into the Republican talking points. There was no raid on Donald Trump's house. They actually got a subpoena beforehand.
I said it was a search and seizure. A search warrant.
But it was a search.
And it was based on a warrant. Yeah, it was based on a warrant.
They knew about it ahead of time. Their lawyers knew about it ahead of time. The people came in regular clothes. They weren't even wearing... The only people that had weapons there were the people that were securing Donald Trump. So I'm just saying that we have got to get this where people don't think that it's like an assault, ambush.
I agree with you. I don't think I said raid. I think I started the R word and backed off quickly. They were executing a search warrant, and they did it all together in the normal manner.
Right. But I think we need to say in a normal manner like that, because otherwise the right-wingers all of a sudden think they have a leg to stand on, and they really don't. Second is 80% of the day of a congressperson is spent dialing for dollars. 80%. So just think about that. Only 20% is actually done towards their job. And that's why Citizens United is so important to get rid of. And I know you guys agree with me on that, but 80% of each day of a congressperson is spent on dialing for dollars, begging people for money for these campaigns, which is just the most disgusting thing on the earth. And the other thing is, again, can you name for me legislation in the last 50 years that the Republicans have passed or the Republicans have put forward that has been there for the average working person? Because I can't. And the thing is, we've really got to get it clear that the Democrats are the party that is actually for the working person. They're trying to put up legislation and pass laws that are for the average working person. Thank you very much. Sandy, you know I love you, but I want us to make sure that when our messaging gets out there, we don't fall into this right-wing, you know, talking points that we heard on the corporate media, because that's what all the media is corporate, MSNBC, everyone. So thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Hey, Tom, thank you very much for the call. Sandy, you want to respond to any of that?
No, I think he has a point.
So let me do this. I want to do this quickly, and then we'll... Steve Bannon attacks Mike Pence for defending FBI, and he called Mike Pence gutless. So, you know, here's a prime example of what has happened to the Republican Party. When Mike Pence was the VP of Donald Trump, he defended everything that Donald Trump did. He would fall on the sword for him, right?
Well, you know, here's what's the problem, really, is that someone like Steve Bannon can say something and actually gets quoted in national media, because Steve Bannon is a weird dude.
Yeah,
who basically the only person he ever had any credibility with was Donald Trump, and his screwball internet network, and then he got ousted from both of those situations, and is now sort of a fringe player. My God, you know, so we've got Steve Bannon saying something and we're talking about it. Who should give a damn about what Steve Bannon has to say?
You know, it's not to me. It's the fact that a guy like Mike Pence, who was a credible guy,
right,
Whether you were Republican or Democrat, the one thing you could say about Mike Pence was that Mike Pence at least was a guy who was thoughtful.
Well, here's what I'll say about Mike Pence. He did the right thing on January 6th, and he seemed to be he put principles above power when it came down to some fundamental issues of the, for instance, the most important thing, this peaceful transfer of power in the United States government. And so I got to hand it to, you know, Mike Pence did the right thing. Steve Bannon was a part of trying to turn national politics and Republican politics into the World Wrestling Federation, giving everyone nicknames, and certainly he's got the nickname now for Mike Pence.
You know,
Gutless. I think that was Donald Trump's version of a nickname for him too. I think he called him that on January 6th.
You know, I want to get into now, Sandy. I'm sure you're aware that there are conversations being had right now that have been ramped up on peace negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. You know, does that mean that not only Vladimir Putin, but Zelensky, they're looking at the oncoming winter and saying, hey, we better try to, you know.
Well, neither of the principals in this fight
will
ever say that they're interested in a peace negotiation, because it'll look like they're
surrendering.
And there was some suspicion that the Erdogan UN visit to Zelensky, while it was supposedly about the Zhybarysk, the nuclear plant there, whose name I have trouble pronouncing because it's got, I think, three Z's in it.
If Sandy can't pronounce it, I'm certainly not going to try.
Yeah, it's got too many Z's, and they're too close together. But, there was a notion that they were there to talk to him about shipments of grain and the nuclear plant, and they undoubtedly talked about those things, but there's also suspicion that they were talking to Zelensky about opening peace talks, and that I think Erdogan has tried to position himself as the broker for peace. He's maintained discussions between both Putin and Zelensky. And my hope is that he can serve that process, that there need to be peace negotiations, that the notion that this can be resolved on the battlefield leads to very bad outcomes for America, for the world, for Ukraine, for Russia. It's not going to work well. And the notion that it can get to one party having a clearly victorious position or the other party having one is very unlikely.
Well, so there's some struggling now from the allies and the promises that they've made to continue to arm Ukraine. And that's getting to be more and more difficult for
these nations. Putin, some of Putin's speculation, that some of it was attributed to him and some he actually talked about himself, is coming true. You know, the UK and Europe is experiencing inflation at more than 10%. The impact on their economies is greater than on ours by a long shot. The budget impact of what they're doing on behalf of Ukraine has got a bigger impact on their military budgets than it does on ours. So they're experiencing much more of the brunt of this than America is. You know, we've got a slowing down of our and a downward turn on our energy prices. They have a shift upward, and they have winter yet to come when gas will be the source of heat, and they're going to be very short of gas. The expectation is that the price of gas will fly up during the winter months in Europe. So there's a lot of clouds on the horizon, economically speaking and socially speaking. And then there's just this problem of having a static war ongoing in Ukraine for a long time, and people have had a lot of trouble, a lot more trouble, visualizing what the outcome of that war is as in terms of being less painful than the war itself. But will peace, will an extended war and the outcome of war be as painful as the war itself, or do we need to have a negotiated settlement sooner rather than later? And I think more and more people undoubtedly are reaching the judgment that a negotiated settlement is a pretty good idea.
Well, you know, the NATO allies want to see that happen. You're draining them. They don't have the resources that the United States has. And if they make a promise to give $2 billion worth of munitions or money, that's a major sacrifice for many of those nations. And they can't continue that. And Ukraine is saying, hey, give me more. You made a promise to us. And these other nations are saying, hey, we're tapped out.
Right. So, like I say, reality setting in, and the reality of a long and extended war is very troublesome, and the reality of a peace that's the result of war without negotiation is also very troublesome. And so, you know, with the fact that there are there are three ways this thing can proceed. One is the war that never ends. One is a war that ends in one side or the other being vanquished. Or the third one is a compromise settlement. And the only one of those that has a very satisfactory outcome as far as the general public, the world public, the European public, the American, etc., is a compromised negotiated settlement.
Can that happen without the United States at the table?
Well, I don't know if we're at the table, but we're definitely...
No, I say, can a peace...
Well, I'm not sure...
...deal be brokered without the United States?
I'm not sure we would be at the table, but we would certainly
behind
be
the scenes,
behind the scenes and behind the curtain having a great deal of influence, because our willingness to continue to provide munitions and support is a strong factor in Zelensky's capacity to either deny negotiation or to proceed.
All right. All right, we've got to go to a break. Our phone lines are open, as always, at 844-967-2789. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Friday. It's Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Buddy Epson is the guy who played Jed from the Beverly Hillbillies, Jed Clampett. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. Don't see him much in military movies. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Fridays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, the nuclear plant that Dave was talking about the other day that seems to be at the center of what is scaring the bejesus out of the rest of the world. Are you fearful that, I mean, they both sides know, and the world knows.
Well, I mean,
are you fearful that there can be something can happen?
Well, I think what they're fearful is that, there's two different versions of what's going on. The Ukrainian version is that the Russians are using it as a safe harbor, place to hide and to have artillery fired from, so that it can have a safe harbor where it can't be fired at without endangering the safety of the nuclear plant. And it is true that the unbridled fission of a nuclear plant, were it all to break and were they unable to stop it, you could have a meltdown. You could have a serious radiation leakage from it. And so I think what they're worried about is that somehow the warfare could leak from it, whether it's the Ukrainian version or the Russian version, which is that the Ukrainians are shelling it. Presumably they'd be shelling it because there are Russians there. So, you know, the UN and the rest of the world wants to demilitarize that area, make it devoid of any military targets so that it would be off limits then for the danger that would be experienced by from artillery or rockets.
Well, both sides know. I mean, Russia is right there. Any fallout or from that certainly can cause mayhem and havoc in Russia. I mean,
Well, I think it endangers. Well, they're apt to be careful, but in warfare in particular, efforts to be surgically precise can fail, right? So you could decide you have a surgically precise rocket, you're going to send it in to knock out that artillery or whatever it is that's at the Zaporizhzhia power plant. That might have been the right way to say it. And then it misses, you know, and it instead of striking the artillery, it causes damage to the plant that in turn causes leakage. I mean, I think it's legit to worry about nuclear plants in the context of warfare. I think it's interesting because long ago I was involved with trying to get approval for nuclear plants in Wisconsin, and a fellow named David Comey appeared, and his testimony at the time was that the safety of nuclear plants, all the probabilities of loss and risk and everything, weren't taking into account sabotage and warfare, and everyone laughed and poo-pooed at that, and now here we have it, you know. And the fact is that, is it safe to have a power center, an electric power center, that isn't safe during warfare when it appears that warfare is a periodic risk for mankind? You know?
Yeah.
So, but anyway, that's an aside. I think it's a legitimate fear, and I think that steps are being taken, but I think that having large nuclear installations in a place where war can happen does put the locality and the region at risk of radiation.
You know, what I don't and never will understand, Sandy, is you and I are at war. You're trying to destroy us. I'm trying to destroy you.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it is, so all of a sudden we're gonna have some common sense when there's no common sense at all involved in what's going on with this war, one ready to slaughter the other, and now all of a sudden we're going to...
Well, you know, it isn't quite like that. War isn't done totally
haphazard
helter-skelter,
or reckless, right.
Recklessly, because each of them... For instance, Ukraine wants to get aid from the United States, and we've said, we'll give you rockets, but you cannot fire them at Russia.
Right.
And I think that they will, until they become totally both reckless and desperate, they will abide by that because they want to keep getting rockets
right.
from us. And the whole grain being exported from Ukraine and Russia facilitating that has to do with both Russia and Ukraine wanting to maintain relations with the rest of the world
right.
that don't shut them off entirely from the kind of support
and,
they might
and
want.
Both needing the financial resources.
Yeah, and both of them need the rest of the world in spite of the statements to the contrary. Russia needs to have access through the Bosporus Straits into the Mediterranean and the Atlantic, and they need Turkey for that. So that if they enrage Turkey, that they've got a problem.
You know, Sandy, it's when did this start? In February?
February, yeah. February 24th,
okay.
I believe.
There's been a lot of destruction in that time. In Ukraine and very little, if any, in Russia. And I don't know how, you know, you look at you.
Well, it's interesting. You know, it looks like that's another situation where there's an attempt at rationality overriding warfare, because Russia has basically announced that it would be a red line for Ukraine to attack Russia proper when here it is Russia that's attacked Ukraine. But Ukraine seems to basically be being abiding by it and has very carefully only attacked several military objectives very close to their border. And maybe that distance is limited by the ability of their weaponry to get into Russia and to attack portions of Russia. But the United States has probably also made it very clear to Ukraine that they don't want to inflame Russia by putting Russia's back up against the wall in a manner that would cause Russia to take a broader view of who their enemy is in this war.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. To the Earl Ingram Show, as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, we're all over the map, and I'm glad we are. I wanted to talk about the economy, because what if they've raised the interest rates three different times already? And each time with 0.75%, which really in any normal time would be a large bump all at once, right? I mean, you would see them raising it 0.25%, but now they did it three different times at 0.75%. So things still kind of, well, you don't sense it.
Well, economists, I think, watching this, you know, it's always easy to be Monday morning quarterbacks, say, you know, they let inflation go too long. They kept coming up with excuses for the inflation. Well, it's a shortage here, but it's temporary. That's what it's caused by. Or it's COVID. And as soon as COVID gets behind us, it won't be there anymore. And instead of it going away, it got stronger. And of course, there is this inflationary psychology, and that's really at the basis of psychology. People begin to decide it's going to be more expensive tomorrow. I'll buy it today. And that decision is particularly supported if wages are going up somewhat at the same time. And, of course, that is what's happening now. We have shortage of labor. We've got shortages generally. Inflation has a real hold. You go back to the prior experience on it during the late 70s and before Jimmy Carter, but then Jimmy Carter is elected, and the Federal Reserve had a very incremental approach like it does now. They were just upping it a little bit, and nope, still got inflation, upping it a little bit. Nope, still got inflation. I think inflation was up at 8 or 9, 10%, and got up to maybe 11%. And then Paul Volcker watches this and said, well, you know, you can't do this incrementally. You got to hit inflation over the head. You know, we've got the cancer of inflation. We're going to give it some chemotherapy. And so he drove interest rates up by percentage points, multiple percentage points at one swell foop kind of a thing. And, it got all the way up to 20%. And interest rates, prevailing interest rates, mortgage rates got up to 13, 14%. It was painful.
It shut everything down.
Well, it caused a real recession, caused Jimmy Carter to lose an election. But it killed inflation, hit it over the head. It hasn't reared its ugly head again until now. And now we have the Fed again using this incremental approach, thinking that 0.75% would be a sufficient announcement to the world, the public, that inflation was going to be put under control, and so far, not clear. Okay, the jury's out. There's still a hope, but the jury's out on this thing. And so now there's really a hope, maybe, that through both better fiscal management, but also through some economic management of the economy, if we could stop shortages, if we could try and get the economy moving in a direction that it could respond to the shortages more effectively and take materials out of short supply, maybe that could help. But there continue to be shortages around the horn, and the worry is that some of the things that look like creating worry for us is excess inventory. So, you know, we've got I think Kohl's has reported poor performance based to some extent on excess inventories. Some of the other Retailers have found out that excess retail can be a real problem.
But
and so if they start scaling back inventory, now we got the stuff recession is made out of.
But Sandy, here's what I don't understand. A year ago, the supply chain problem, they were concerned about whether or not there's going to be enough, you know, inventory for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And we understood why, because, you know, the bottleneck and all those things. Hasn't that eased up, being able to get the supplies back in, or is it the problem now with the production things?
The problem is actually more specific than that. Most of the people who've had inventory problems bulked up on the inventory of the stuff that people were buying during the pandemic. People were buying lots of things for their homes, home furnishings.
They had extra money.
Home furnishings.
Right.
They were buying things at the hardware store. They were buying landscaping things. Those people bulked up on the inventory because they wanted to have enough the next year to make all that money, right? And now with the post-pandemic, the appetite for all those things has shifted to other things. So what we have now is inventory problems that are quite specific to changes in retail appetite as much as anything. But the lesson learned there is that you get your inventory too high, just like always. That was a lesson everyone knows in retail. Too much inventory, big problem. And so now we've got people worried that there is a recession looming. Even though we've got shortage, what are we going to do about that? And maybe we shouldn't order too much stuff.
Well, you know, Sandy, during that time, as you and I and many other people well know, that was at the time that the government was giving people $1,200 checks and,
right.
And people who normally, and that allowed them to purchase things that they wouldn't have been able to purchase. That money was flowing.
Right.
And so maybe they got a little greedy, huh?
Well, yeah, it's not greediness. It's just the marketplace trying to make decisions. I mean, you know, you base your inventory on what you did last year and what you think you're going to do next year.
Yeah, but don't you look at the fact that this government money was coming in?
Well, but it's not easy if you just run a store to figure out exactly why. And so you're basically reacting based on the data you understand and know, and nobody knows the broad marketplace. And in fact, I don't think anybody was good at guessing exactly how these appetites would change as the result of the pandemic, and nobody really knows how the appetites are going to change as the pandemic fades. You know, people are still getting it, right?
Right.
Lots of people. And appetites in the marketplace are changing. Appetites for work are changing. Economists still can't get their arms around what's happening in the workplace and why it is that people seem to be shortages in almost every area for workers.
Hey, Bob, thank you very much for hanging in there. Thank you for the call. You say what, sir?
Well, good morning, first off. Just want to point out a couple of details. The CEO average wage income is 670 times the average worker wage. I liked the way Richard Nixon handled inflation, and that was to challenge companies and labor to not increase their prices on goods or their prices on labor, and that helped reduce the that helped eliminate inflation at that point. And I look at the way we're approaching getting money to the poor is investing in American people. That there's a very important element in the strength of our nation, and they need to be reinvested in. So the money that we take from the wealthy is not just being taken from them, it's being reinvested in our country, and it'll eventually work its way up through the economy. I'm going to get off the phone and listen to you. Thank you much.
Hey, Bob, thank you very much for the call. Thank you for listening. Sandy, you want to respond to anything Bob had to say?
Well, Nixon, I mean, he also implemented some price controls, actual government controls. And
you mean regulation?
Yeah, regulation. So Nixon hadn't yet abandoned the notion that government was a tool that needed to be used for the purpose of helping the American economy operate in its best possible way. There is some merit to the notion that there is a bully pulpit that could do something, particularly about prices. I'm a little reluctant, and I'm sort of sorry to see that as soon as inflation rears its ugly head, we start wanting to clamp down on wages. Tom, Dick, and Mary have had their wages increasing well below the CPI for a substantial number of years now, and here we are probably just playing catch-up during this period of shortage where the wages are moving up at a clip, not many of them moving up at the clip of the current inflation level, 8 or 10%. And now we're starting to talk about putting a lid on wages when wages are probably just beginning to creep forward to catch up with their lagging behind the CPI for a substantial number of years. The American business model has sort of been premised on increasing production levels out of workers without increasing their wages and increasing profitability thereby, and so I'm reluctant to propose that American policy had put a lot of restrictions on wage increases, but I think we ought to find a way to solve for shortages, and I think we ought to try and persuade people that the Federal Reserve will take the steps necessary to cure inflation, because what we need to get rid of is inflation psychology.
So the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise rates. Do you foresee them raising them to a point at a time as opposed to what they've been doing with three quarters? There is some movement or impact with what they've done, but it's moving at a very slow pace.
Well, I for one think that it would be better for them to pull the sword out rather than simply rattle it.
Just raise it 2 points.
Raise it 2 points and say, look, this is going to stop, and we're going to do two now, and if it doesn't slow down, we're going to do more, and that would help erase the psychology. People would begin to believe it. The stock market is currently not believing what their policy
right.
is because the stock market keeps believing, based on the inversion of the yield curve as well as the way the stock market behaves, that interest rates are going to go down pretty soon. They're going to go
the
up.
The stock market hasn't suffered as much.
And that's all related to the vision of long-term interest rates returning to a low norm. And so that means they aren't really believing that inflation's going to continue, which means that they're probably overestimating the capacity of the current rate increases to throttle inflation.
But Sandy, those people who are, making these pronouncements on what they think is going to be, the interest rates are going to be, and so with their investments, they got to know that we're still kind of out there on the limb and we're in no man's land. We know something's going to be changing quickly.
Well, there's a strong upward bias in Wall Street. Everyone, all these guys who manage other people's money want to make sure they don't miss any of the upward movement in the market because they all get graded by their returns relative to the.
But it doesn't always go up.
Well, it doesn't always go up, but there's a bias in their view that they are.
It's worth the risk.
That they're hoping it goes up, and it's important to them that it goes up, and basically, Wall Street is, if they were, they don't play small ball, okay? If they had a baseball team, they would have 9 home run hitters sitting on the bench who all get paid for hitting the long ball. And because in Wall Street, you get penalized some for missing the mark going up, but you always get penalized for missing the mark that you could have made going up. So there's a strong bias to believe it's going to go up. And so I believe that Wall Street and the stock market tends to be forecasting what they hope for more than what they actually will happen.
So how far out ahead can they get on projections I mean, before you know it, the holidays are going to be here. And do they go out that far ahead?
Oh, man. The stock market is really premised on long-term views of ahead. And my concern about the stock market has always been they put far too much weight on the near-term result when it's really what's going to happen in years 2 through 12 out in the future that would dictate what the value of a stock is.
All right, so we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. So, I mean,
I'm so sorry. What did I do wrong? I said, what did I do wrong? Please forgive me, baby, and come on home.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk from Muskego to Pewaukee. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. Text us that same number. It's Sandy Williams Show. You know, Sandy, and maybe it's because, I can only see it through the prism of, the way recessions and the impact that they had on during the time that I have been alive. And when we'd go into these recessions, I would see this. You could measure the change in people and their lives because they had less money, just across the board. Because as you stated before, with the layoffs and all those things, and so people had to really tighten their belt. They were forced to tighten their belt because the paycheck wasn't there.
Yeah,
the unemployment you would get, and all unemployment could do was tide you over, and then the safety net stuff that would help tide you over until things straightened out and you were able to get back to where you were.
I mean, recessions, there's a recessionary spiral, downward spiral, just like there's an inflationary psychology that creates an inflationary spiral upwards. You know, when you get into a recession, people lose their jobs, they lose their capacity to buy things.
Right.
They have to start saving very carefully to try and... So all of that creates shrinkage in the economy, which creates a shrinkage in forward-looking planning for the economy, which creates more shrinkage. And that's why this whole Keynesian view of economics develop, which is you got to prime that pump. When you get into a recession or a depression, you have to start injecting some money into the economy because otherwise it's going to go into this shrinking spiral and it'll get worse and worse. Inflation, opposite. People think things are going to get more expensive in the future, so they buy it today. So they bid the price up today, and the prices go up faster and faster. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the economic world is filled with self-fulfilling prophecies. When people come to actually believe things are going to get worse, they will get worse. When people come to believe that things are going to get more expensive, they will get more expensive. It works like that. And the problem with leaving the solution to inflation to the Federal Reserve is it will cause recession. And when it causes recession, then you need to figure out ways to solve for it. But if we have a recession on top of shortage economy, then it's very hard for the government to feed more money into the economy because you might just feed inflation.
So I've noticed several weeks ago, it was almost a foregone conclusion. You were hearing people talk about recession. I'm not hearing it, as if it's imminent. anymore.
Well, the reason it was they were talking like that, and then the jobs data came out several weeks ago that revealed that instead of having 245,000 jobs added like economists were projecting, it was something like 513,000
right.
jobs. It was more than twice the amount estimated. And suddenly people said, oh, gosh, that means we aren't in recession if we're adding jobs at that rate. And so then the question is, how long does that happen? Or does, you know, as soon as the job increase starts shrinking materially, we'll be back to talking about recession again.
Which is inevitable to shrink because as long as the interest rates, inflation, as long as inflation is where it is, eventually the jobs have to decrease. Is that?
Well, you know, that's true, except that the problem with economic warfare, if you figure the economic cycle as being sort of the government against the economy trying to figure out how to control it, the
right.
economy is the beast and the government is trying to control it, you're always fighting the last war and the next one's always different, okay? And so now we have an unusual circumstance of this change in job characteristics and the workplace characteristics, shortages, okay? We have shortages all over the place, and everyone needs to be hiring, but we also have shortages of goods. We have inflation created by the shortage of goods. This need to hire is causing people to increase wages, which is further supporting the increase in the price of goods. So we're going to have inflation that's got these powerful undercurrents creating it. And now we've got to figure out, well, can we solve shortage fast enough to get over the shortage contribution to the creation of inflation? Or do we just have to hit inflation over the head with the Federal Reserve hammer of increased interest rates? So far, the only thing that seems to have any merit is the hammer that's held in the hands of the Federal Reserve. But the question is, are they using a little tack hammer, or are they using a ball peen or something heavier that will actually hit it over the head?
Well, they're trying for what they call a smooth landing, right?
Soft landing.
Yeah.
They want a soft landing. They want to solve inflation without creating recession, and they're walking a dance. And the question is, okay, this is what they were kind of doing in the 70s, too, until Volcker came along and used a sledgehammer.
Right.
And jacked up interest rates a lot. So,
but which they don't want to see again.
Well, people don't want to see that again. So what we need to do is come up with a more multifaceted approach to this particular situation. If we have an inflation-induced problem that is going to cause recession, if we leave the hammer in the hands of the Federal Reserve, we've got to find some other ways to deal with it. Some of it is fiscal, which would be reserving the amount of excess money that's spent by the government, but that's a bit hard in the current environment. Or are we going to do other things to solve for shortage? And the problem there is we can't quite figure out how to solve the workplace marketplace problem.
You know, Sandy, historians, do they look at this from a historical perspective? Those economists and others who are looking at this in a historical perspective, does it give them, you know, pause to say, well, maybe this worked during that time, but it won't work during this? There's no exact science, I guess, is what I'm hearing you.
Well, there's no exact science, but everyone who's hired to be an expert has to come forward with expertise. What do they base their expertise on, intuition or history? People tend to use history as something they can point at, so we tend to repeat mistakes. And I think that's the reason we repeat mistakes, because people are not confident about using their intuition. They want to be able to show their client what the facts are that they're basing their proposed actions
on.
So
even the greatest economist is kind of like out on a limb. There's no exact science with it.
Right. There's economics is not an exact science. And as much as economists try to show that it can be handled with mathematical algorithms and solutions, not the case.
All right, we got to run. Thank you, Sandy, as always. Have a great weekend. Thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Connor. We'll be back on Monday. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.